Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Let's take a quick peek ahead at the news to come this week. Countrywide Financial is going to report third quarter profits on Friday. It'll be a loss for sure, possibly close to $1 billion, depending on who you talk to, because huge bunches of the company's subprime loans have gone bad. Today, Countrywide tried to keep some of them good. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Grant Thornton, dedicated to serving their clients worldwide with a passion for the business of accounting. On the web at grantthornton.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today's Tuesday, the 23rd of October, and it's great to have you here. Any resemblance to The Godfather is purely coincidental, I'm sure, but Countrywide made some of its customers an offer today that they can't really refuse, not if they want to keep their homes anyway. The nation's biggest mortgage lender said it's going to reach out to about 82,000 of its borrowers and refinance or otherwise modify about $16 billion worth of home loans. That's a pretty small slice of the loans Countrywide has outstanding, but it is just the kind of thing the Bush administration has been pushing for. And consumer advocates say something is better than nothing. Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
Millions of Americans with adjustable-rate home loans face rising payments between now and the end of next year. The mortgage industry is under mounting pressure to do something to head off a looming foreclosure crisis. Just last week, Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson warned of what he called an immediate need for more loan restructurings. Today, Countrywide promised to assist borrowers who have a willingness and wherewithal to remain in their homes. The reprieve would not apply to those who fall behind because they've lost their jobs or if they lack the income to keep up with more favorable mortgage terms. Consumer advocates hailed the move as an important step. John Taylor, who heads the National Community Reinvestment Coalition, hopes it'll spur other lenders to offer similar relief.
I do actually think that there are a lot of players in the financial services sector, banks in particular, that are recognizing we can't allow 2 million foreclosures to drag this economy and the financial services sector down.
But working out better terms with lenders might be easier said than done in many other cases. Nicholas Ritsinas heads Harvard University's Center for Housing Studies. He points out many mortgages have been bundled, sold, and then passed along in packages to other buyers.
In some cases, the lenders were just originating the mortgages. The mortgages are actually held by investors. Investors as far-reaching as the Central Bank of China, hedge funds, a whole variety of investors, not even sure they hold some of these mortgages.
House Democrats have just proposed a measure aimed at dealing with that problem. It would let borrowers sue the big Wall Street banks that buy and resell those mortgages if the homeowners can show there was no effort made to verify their ability to realistically pay back their loan. In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Your retirement savings plan might have gotten a boost today, and you probably didn't even notice. Last year, Congress passed and the president signed something called the Pension Protection Act. The law makes it easier for companies to automatically enroll their workers in retirement plans, like 401ks. Today, the Labor Department published its rules for how that's going to happen and what kinds of plans will be covered. And it's clear the government favors investments that take some risks. Marketplace's Sarah Gardner reports.
Starting next year, companies can automatically enroll their workers into a plan of the company's choosing. Under rules announced today, the Labor Department made it clear it favors three types of funds. They're diversified and involve a mix of stocks and bonds. More conservative investments, like those sold mainly by the insurance industry, were not included. That's a win for mutual fund companies, which lobbied regulators heavily on this issue.
We made our views known quite strongly.
Ed Giltenan is with the Investment Company Institute, the main trade group for the mutual fund industry.
People are are trying to accumulate assets over a long period of time. And I think the Department of Labor very wisely chose investment vehicles that will permit them to do that.
In the past, many companies enrolled their workers in low-yielding but safer investments for fear of being sued by employees if their retirement funds lost a lot of money. Under this law, companies that default workers into these typically higher-yielding investments will be shielded more from potential lawsuits. Mark Ivry is a principal with the Retirement Security Project.
They're a way station to draw millions of American workers away from investing most or all of their long-term savings too cautiously, all in money market funds for 40 years, for example, or too riskily, all or most in the stock of their own employer.
The Labor Department says right now up to a third of workers eligible for 401ks never sign up. Supporters of automatic enrollment believe it could raise participation rates to 95%. The rest will choose to opt out. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Maybe you knew this already, but the green card that U.S. permanent residents get, it's not really green. It's more pinkish, actually. But color aside, today the European Union proposed its own version with a couple of twists. First of all, theirs will be called a blue card after the blue flag of the EU. And also, it's not about permanent residency. It's about the next generation of computer programmers and engineers. And that has American businesses worried. Marketplace's Dan Gretsch reports.
The European Union faces a shortage of 20 million skilled workers over the next 20 years, so it's streamlining its immigration process. Under the proposal, foreign workers would fill out a single application for any of the EU's 27 member nations. Workers would get their blue card in 1 to 3 months. Tamar Jacoby is an immigration expert at the Manhattan Institute.
A European blue card is bad news for the U.S. because it means Europe is going to start to do a better job at competing for these skilled workers.
Blue cards would require employers to offer a one-year contract, a salary 3 times minimum wage, and health coverage. Countries would set their own blue card quotas. Robert Hoffman's co-chair of the Compete America Coalition.
The EU's blue card really should be a red flag to the U.S. Congress. It's time to wake up and change our policies in recognition of this growing competition for talent.
The U.S. faces a massive backlog in H-1B visas for skilled workers. This year's quota of 65,000 was surpassed on its first day. Stuart Anderson's with the National Foundation for American Policy.
Currently, if an international student graduates from a U.S. university, they may have to wait a year before they could work in the United States. That's just too long for people who are ambitious and have many other options.
Critics of U.S. immigration policy say the blue card may have a silver lining. It may spur Congress to action. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
There were some blurbles on Wall Street today as investors tried to figure out which way was up. They eventually did, and we'll have the details when we do the numbers. Out here in Los Angeles today, there's a distinct orange haze in the air from all the smoke, and you can smell the forest fires that are burning all over Southern California. President Bush declared 7 counties federal disaster areas this morning, which will get government help here all the faster. At last count, as many as 500,000 people have been evacuated, 2 men have died, and somewhere near 1,500 homes have been destroyed. The insurance bill will be steep, in the hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars. But chances are, that's not going to change the way we live, here in California or anywhere else. We've got Martin Grace on the line. He's a professor of risk management at Georgia State University. Professor Grace, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you.
You know, in the wake of Katrina, we had lots of insurance companies canceling policies for people and for homeowners who lived nowhere near hurricane zones. Are we now going to see more of the same thing out here?
The fire risk is a different kind of risk than the wind risk. First of all, the Katrina-like wind risk was kind of unforeseen. And the fire risk, we've had a bit of experience for, and it's most likely to be part of the general risks that the insurance companies believe that they are bearing. Well, this is pretty bad, of course, but it's probably not something out of the ordinary for what the insurance companies would think that they would be covering.
Going forward now, as a guy running an insurance company, are you not watching CNN now saying, oh man, we have to do something about this because people are going to keep building out there. They're going to rebuild in northern San Diego County and out in Malibu. It's not like people are going to stop living out here.
Well, one of the things they can do, and this is a little bit different than the hurricane risk issue, but it looks the same, is that they're going to say, you know, while we're having drought conditions that are conducive to these types of fires, we might either raise our prices or restrict availability in these areas. Insurance is a voluntary business. It's very difficult to force insurance companies to sell policies. You know, no one's going to be in business if they can't make any money.
These insurance companies are for-profit businesses, and they have to offer their product to make the money to stay in business. If they keep not offering coverage in more and more areas because of events like Katrina or the fires that we're having out here this week, aren't they sort of doing violence to their own business model?
You know, that's a good question. I think part of it has to do is that after every time you have a big calamity, it takes two, three, four, 5 years for the insurers to figure out how to price it and how to think about it. Once the industry kind of figures out how to do it, they'll be more willing to do it in the future. And as long as the Department of Insurance allows them to price those risks, the companies are going to still be willing to sell those policies. The problem is that people are going to start saying, insurance prices are too high, do something about it. But it is a political cost to be borne by the people who say, you know, let's let the market work.
That's the question, right?
Yeah.
Does the market work?
Well, it does work. It signals that you're living in a very risky place. And if you want to stay there, you're going to have to pay a higher price for that coverage of risk.
Do you think in the final analysis, as a guy who does this for a living, that the insurance market is going to change consumer behavior, as it were?
If the government has the guts to stay out of this in the short run and not put too many conditions on the insurance industry, the market will evolve to price things properly. And so the prices in high-risk areas will go up. Development will slow or stop. You know, the idea of free markets giving the people the right incentives to make decisions that make themselves better off is good for everyone.
So it's politics or the market here, right?
Yes, and I think people don't trust the market.
Martin Grace is a professor of risk management at Georgia State University. Professor Grace, thanks so much for your time.
Oh, you're welcome, and I enjoyed it.
Those low, low prices at Walmart are really nothing new. Bargain hunting goes back to ancient Rome, you know. But sometimes it's not how much you pay, but where you find things. Commentator Marionette Pember says for Native Americans, the town dump has historically been a key part of the economy.
I recently learned about the freegan movement. Freegans are a group of socially conscious folks who engage in something they call waste reclamation. They are the ultimate recyclers, righteously enjoying the luxury of choice as they dig through dumpsters and landfills. Native Americans have been employing waste reclamation for centuries. We call it going to the dump because we're too poor not to. For many people on the reservation, the dump has been a store with infinite variety and a drive-in movie theater all rolled into one. During my career as a Native journalist covering Indian country, I have found that the dump looms large for many Native folks. The economic necessity to reclaim waste and scrounge for entertainment seems to be intertribal. An Iowa friend remembers the dump as the Indian furniture store for his mobile family. At each new home, his dad would announce, "We need some furniture, kids. Let's go to the dump." In my Ojibwa mother's day, the dump was even a date destination. She recalls the time she wore her famous silk stockings to watch her beau shoot rats at the dump. In retrospect, she noted she was a bit overdressed. My Ojibwa colleague reports that his brother could never resist carrying home old radios from the dump and plugging them in. At best, nothing happened. At worst, they sparked and blew all the fuses in the house, causing his dad to yell, "You guys are no good." Native people are born to making do with what life offers us. We go to the dump when we need to. We go with humor and a genuine spirit of discovery. In true Indian form, we laugh in the face of such forces that seek to grind our spirits down. Recalling the importance of landfills in our lives, we soar high above the dump, so high that it doesn't really touch us.
Marionette Pember is a freelance print journalist. Her work focuses primarily on Native American people and their issues. She's a member of the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior Chippewa Tribe in Wisconsin. Send us your comments. If you like, our website is marketplace.org. Coming up, Greens push a new power play.
This is not tweaking things at the margin. This is an enormous energy resource.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials rose 0.8%. Today, 109 points to close at 13,676. The NASDAQ rose 1.75%. That's 45 points to close at 2799. The S&P 500 moved up 0.75%, 13 points to end the day at 1519. Apple shot up another 6.75% today after it posted record earnings after the bell yesterday. Shares in American Express rang up a 3% gain. It saw its profits rise 10%. Internet retailer Amazon booked a 10% gain ahead of a glowing profit report. The company's third quarter revenue rose 41% to $3.25 billion. Thank you, Harry Potter. Bond prices remained unchanged. The yield on the 10-year T-note stayed put at 4.41%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by U.S. Trust, Bank of America Private Wealth Management, committed to understanding the values that truly matter to clients and offering a personal approach to managing their wealth. And by Siemens, from generators that power cities to light bulbs for homes, from factory automation to medical diagnostics, Siemens 70,000 U.S. employees providing solutions for America. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Sustainability Fund of the Tides Foundation, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet. Heard a report on Marketplace that you just have to share with your friends, family, or coworkers? Help is just a click away. Our website has each day's complete newscast, individual stories, and transcripts, so you can listen again, print them out, or email them to everyone you know. It's all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the National Association of Realtors reports on sales of existing homes for September. The House Budget Committee discusses the growing costs of the Iraq War. And baseball fans turn their attention to Boston, the Rockies versus the Red Sox in the first game of the World Series. The Fall Classic is expected to generate millions in ad revenue. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The war on terror came to a Dallas courtroom yesterday, and the government lost, or didn't win, to be more precise. The Bush administration's six-year case against a group called the Holy Land Foundation ended in a mistrial. The Justice Department had accused Holy Land of being a front for terrorist financing for the Palestinian group Hamas. It was the third high-profile terrorist financing case where the government's come away with less than what it had hoped for. Dennis Lormel ran the FBI's terrorist financing task force. He's now with the consulting firm Corporate Risk International. Mr. Lormel, good to have you with us.
Thanks, I appreciate it.
Why is it so hard for the government to win terrorist financing cases?
Well, these cases are very complex, and obviously terrorists are going to do what they can to hide their involvement. And a particular case that I think brings this to light right now is the Holy Land Foundation. And by either commingling terrorist funds or hiding them and manipulating the system a bit and throwing up a number of different smoke screens, it becomes more challenging for the government to make these types of cases. And the Holy Land case is a case in point.
Well, when you were with the FBI and running the terrorist financing task force there after September 11th, as you sat at that table and tried to figure out whether to follow the money or to take these guys to court, what were your parameters? What was that discussion?
Initially, we were looking to take them to court. And then the whole mindset of the government changed in that disruption was more important than prosecution. So we wanted to take disruptive actions wherever we could. Sometimes, as in these cases, going after the terrorists in a criminal case supports the overall terrorism mission. And that was the mindset here, to go after the criminal charges. But what we also have to do is balance the current criminal cases, which are very challenging and difficult to make, with the fact that the government has already had success against Holy Land Foundation when they froze their assets. And in doing that, you really choked that funding stream.
But let me ask you this, though. The government froze those assets back in 2001. 6 years later, the government was unable to win a conviction in court. What does that tell you about the merits of the decision to freeze the assets if you can't convict?
Well, if you go back to the 2001 action, that held up in court. When Holy Land challenged it, the judge in that trial determined that there was enough justification for the government action and cited that in her finding. And then the government won that on appeal also.
You mentioned intelligence information. How much of the fight against terrorist financing is based on secret intelligence information that nobody ever finds out about? And how much is out there in sort of open court?
In cases like this, and in this case in particular, and the case up in Chicago, the Benevolence International, and a case down in Florida, relied on intelligence information, intelligence overhears, that basically were used the intent was to use them to corroborate the intent of the group of subjects involved, that they in fact were members of the terrorist organization, or in fact were sympathizers and wittingly participated.
Let me get back to something you said just a moment ago. These cases are complex. Are they too complex to keep on taking to court?
No. The reality is, if there are cases that are predicated, the government should weigh heavily the prospect of taking those cases to trial. I think that the government made the right decision by taking this case to court, even though it was an incredibly challenging case to bring. And I would expect that they should move to retry the case.
Dennis Lormel spent 30 years with the FBI. He ended up his tours running the Terrorist Financing Task Force in Washington. He's now a senior vice president at the consultant firm Corporate Risk International. Mr. Lormel, thanks a lot for your time.
Oh, thank you, guys. I appreciate it.
There's a quote from Vice President Cheney that leads nicely into this next piece. 6.5 years ago, April of 2001, he was deep in the workings of his energy task force, and he gave a speech to the annual meeting of the Associated Press, where he said, among other things, that conservation is a sign of personal virtue, but it's no basis for a comprehensive energy policy. He caught a lot of grief for that, for the task force, too. But 6 years later, some in the energy industry have taken conservation to heart. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sam Eaton has more.
For most utilities, profits come from selling more electricity, not less. So when Duke Energy's CEO Jim Rogers recently endorsed conservation, it turned heads.
The most environmentally benign plant, power plant that I can build, is the one that I don't build.
Rogers says meeting the country's surging energy demand doesn't have to come from building new power plants. It can come from efficiency.
It's much cheaper than renewables, much cheaper than a new power plant, coal or nuclear. At the same time, it has a zero emissions footprint.
But there's still that nagging detail. If you're in the business of selling electricity, efficiency typically doesn't pay. That's where regulators come in. More than a dozen states have either adopted or are considering measures that reward utilities for reducing electricity demand rather than boosting it. It's called decoupling. Ralph Cavana with the Natural Resources Defense Council says if fully realized, energy efficiency could more than offset the need to build new power plants.
This is not tweaking things at the margin. This is an enormous energy resource.
With an enormous profit potential, in California, which has operated under a decoupled system for more than two decades, utilities are rewarded for investing in conservation. If they reach certain goals, the state lets them charge higher rates. Cavanna says this allows utilities to grow their profits while energy use levels off or even declines. And he says even though Californians use about 50% less energy per capita than the rest of the nation, they can still conserve more.
There is so much low-hanging fruit, and when you pick the low-hanging fruit with energy efficiency, it grows right back. There is no corner of the economy where you can't find cost-effective efficiency if you look.
One of those places is California's Silicon Valley. Warehouse-sized data centers here handle much of the nation's internet traffic. These rooms of power-sucking computers require massive amounts of electricity. But instead of building new power plants, California utilities are paying companies like Sun Microsystems to make these facilities more efficient.
See, these are the chilled water supply lines and the hot returns.
Chief Technology Officer Greg Papadopoulos shows off a new data center at Sun's Santa Clara campus. Innovations in cooling have allowed Sun to more than quadruple its computing power, while at the same time cutting its electricity use by 30%.
You could take one of our new servers and actually replace a whole rack of old servers with it and not increase the power footprint.
But not everyone is pleased with the utilities getting into the conservation business.
I can tell you who the losers are. The losers will be people who pay rates.
Robert Rio is with the Associated Industries of Massachusetts. State utility regulators held hearings today in Boston to consider a decoupling plan of their own. Rio says high electricity rates have already burdened the state's businesses. And he says the only thing that's going to bring those rates down is to build more power plants.
It is very simplistic to say that we're going to conserve our way out of this problem. In fact, I think it's short-sighted, because by the time we find out that conservation was not the only answer, we're going to be behind two power plants and not one power plant, because the danger is we don't have enough power.
By some estimates, the U.S. needs to spend nearly $1 trillion over the next 15 years in order to meet rising electricity demand. But conservation advocates say this only bolsters their case. Investing in energy efficiency is a lot cheaper than building new power plants. And they say in the end, those savings translate into much lower electricity bills. In Los Angeles, I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Consumer Consequences, American Public Media's online game, exploring what the world would be like if everyone on Earth consumed like you. Online at consumerconsequences.org. By the American Public Transportation Association, committed to an energy-independent America by increased use of public transportation. At publictransportation.org. And by Putnam Investments, where a diversified approach to fixed income can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today, you might not expect European lawmakers to get into a tussle over a bug, but then again, stranger things have happened. Volkswagen is now a free agent. Today, the European Court of Justice struck down a law that had been protecting the carmaker from takeover bids. It had been on the books since about 1960, in part to protect jobs in the German state of Lower Saxony. They, that is, Lower Saxons, still do own 20% of VW, but there is a larger stakeholder waiting in the wings. Expectations are that Porsche will try to add to the 31% of Volkswagen it already owns. VW is, by the way, Europe's biggest automaker. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow gained 109 points. That's 0.8%. The NASDAQ added 45 points, 1 2/3%. The S&P 500 rose 13 points, 0.75% there. Thanks today to Renita Jablonski and Miguel Macias on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by John Buckley. Coming up next time on this program, farm subsidies are supposed to help those who need them.
But that safety net, regrettably, has become in many cases a set of golden arches for some of the largest corporate agri-factories in our country.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.